Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last year, almost 30,000 organs, hearts, livers, lungs, and other organs were transplanted from one person to another, just a fraction of the demand, as nearly 100,000 Americans await their own transplants. And more than a third of those people are African Americans waiting for kidneys, posing a critical threat to minority communities. 17 years ago, Howard University transplant surgeon Dr. Clive Callender recognized the danger and founded National Minority Donor Awareness Week to draw attention to the shortage. That's the week we're in right now, and Dr. Callender joins us to talk about it by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, Dr. Callender.
Thank you very much for having me.
Why do African Americans make up such a disproportionate number of patients on the organ transplant lists?
Well, we have more diabetes, almost twice as much diabetes as a cause of kidney failure, and then we have twice as much high blood pressure as a cause for kidney failure. And then we also have glomerular causes. There's a disease called FSGS, which is focal segmental glomerular sclerosis. And then entering, in addition to polycystic kidney disease, is obesity. These are the common causes for kidney failure and why we as African Americans are so disproportionately overrepresented on transplant waiting lists.
So disproportionately represented on the waiting lists. What about the donor lists?
Well, I tell you, there's some good news to share.
Good.
And the good news is that when we started our efforts, especially MOTEP, which we the National Minority Organ Tissue Transplant Education Program, which we started in the 90s, the number of donors, minority donors, was only 15%, and we make up 25% of the population. Good news is that today we make up more than 30%. Of the donors, so that we've doubled our donation rates. And I'm pleased to say that our efforts are partially responsible for that. And I think this National Minority Donor Awareness Day and Week are part and parcel of the reason that the donation rate has increased.
So you've achieved your goals?
Well, we set new goals.
We
first wanted to get to 25%. We passed 25, got to 30. Now we're looking for 35%. That's what we need. Now even that is not enough because we're so disproportionately represented. But it shows that when you talk to the African-American community and the other minority communities, educate them and empower them to make a difference, they will respond.
Back in 1980, you were asked to do a study on why Blacks, African-Americans were reluctant donors. What did you discover at the time?
Well, we found the five reasons African-Americans were reluctant to become donors. The first had to do with a concern about religious. Number one, we were unaware and relatively ignorant of the fact that we were overrepresented on transplant waiting lists and on dialysis. Mm-hmm. And so we had to first go to the community and make them aware of that, number one. Then number two was religious misgivings and fears that it was not the right thing to do to leave organs and tissues, forgetting that it isn't giving that you receive, it isn't pardoning that you are pardoned, it isn't dying that you're born to eternal life. And Christ came and gave his life, and so we must put that away and recognize that virtually all religions are in favor of giving in life and after death, because one of the best things you can do is help save another human life and improve the quality of another human life. So that second obstacle was overcome by education and helping people realize it is the right thing to do. When you get to the pearly gates and you go to heaven, St. Peter will say, you know, your life was mediocre, but what you did at the end of your life when you left those organs for seven lives to be saved, and for some 30 tissues to be left so that the blind could see, the lame could walk, the deaf could hear again, is what got you here.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is Minority Organ Donor Awareness Week. My guest is Dr. Clive Callender. He's Director Emeritus of the Howard University Transplant Program. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Callender, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to get to the other three top five reasons, but when you tried to tackle the religious issues, did the churches pitch in and help you? Were they helping you from the pulpit?
They made the difference. I found that the two areas that were most helpful were the churches and the women. Now, the churches make up most of the people in the women make up most of the people in the churches anyway. But the thing that helped us most in the churches was that many of the church members had these same problems and needed transplants themselves. So therefore, when we went to them, they opened the doors, and that's what made a major part of the difference in addressing their religious misgivings.
What were the other three?
The third was a fear that we were going to be used as guinea pigs, as what happened with the Tuskegee incident, and in other instances, so that we had to convince the communities that they were not going to be used as guinea pigs, and that we have many more African-American and other minorities who are in positions of power to ensure that the Tuskegee incident would not happen again. So that was the third. The fourth had to do with the fear, if I go to the hospital and they know I've signed a donor card, they might just be more interested with getting my organs and tissues than with saving my life. And so we had to educate them and help them realize that the donor teams only come in after they're sure that you're dead, and that we don't hasten in any way the life-saving role that all hospitals and doctors play.
You know, Dr. Kalender, that makes me wonder how broad that, how widespread that particular fear is.
It's
not just the minority community.
Every ethnic group I've ever approached has come up with that one.
Mm-hmm.
So that crosses every line that I know of, and maybe number one overall. The others were particularly unique for our African-American community.
What about number five?
Number five was the fear that racism, which is alive and well, would be an obstacle, because they were afraid that if I give my organs, they will only be used for whites. Now, the reality of it is this, and this helped me very much when I went into the African-American community. Starting transplant at Howard University, where our population was 90% black, 80% of the organs that we used when I started were from whites. So it was clear that misconception was just that, a misconception. And we needed to become more and more a part and parcel of that solution. And so I'm pleased to tell you that now 70% of the organs that we transplant in our black patients come from blacks. And so we've made a tremendous improvement.
Race is not a biological category, but are members of the same ethnic background more likely to be a match for organ donation?
Not really.
Okay.
And I'm so glad you said that race is not a biological issue, because it is not. Ethnicity is what the issue is. And we found that what is more important is the matching of the organs and the tissues, not so much what ethnic group you are. Now, there's exceptions to the rule.
Okay.
For bone marrow transplant, if they're from the same ethnic group, there's a greater likelihood of there being a perfect match, and you need a perfect match for a bone marrow transplant.
Right.
For organ transplants, you don't need a perfect match, and so we found that ethnicity doesn't really matter that much relative to organ transplants. Now, if you're doing a living transplant and you've got a good match, then that's what matters, not the ethnicity.
When we talk about minority groups facing organ shortages, we're not just talking about African-Americans and blacks in general. Do Latinos and Asians face similar challenges?
Yes. As a matter of fact, one thing about MOTEP is that it was for all ethnic minorities, and we have seen the increase in donation rates in the Latino-Hispanic, which actually exceeded the success in the African-American population. We've seen similar success in the Asian populations in the United States.
I denote organ donation on my driver's license. Are there other ways to do it if you don't have a driver's license?
Yes. As a matter of fact, almost every state now has a registry. Usually, if you put in the computer "donate life" and you put the name of the state, then donate life the state.com, then you can get on the registry. And if you get on the registry, the first person is the person that really has the authority. So if you get on the registry and indicate that I want to be a donor, then that should suffice, because then they can go to the computer and check it. And even if your family decides against it, if that's what you wanted, that's what will happen, because it's illegal to do otherwise.
And I wanted to talk about that, because some people obviously are influenced by their families, but when they're gone, they can't do much about it. They're protected on that score. But what do you recommend people do? Shouldn't people tell their families what their decision has been made and have that discussion beforehand?
That's exactly what they should do. However, if in addition you also have a registry, then you could get on the registry. But we all feel that talking to the next of your family and letting them know what you want done with your organs and tissues in life and after you die is something that's very important. And most instances, the family will abide by your wishes. But when there's a difference, the laws, the state laws now protect that first person's request.
And if you haven't made the you haven't obligated yourself in any way as a organ donor, there's no way anyone can take your organs unless you have.
Unless your family. Now, if you haven't done it, then they have to go to your next of kin.
Okay, and they can do it.
Yes.
You went on to found the Minority Organ Tissue Transplant Education Program. What does that organization do now?
What we did, and as a matter of fact, the National Institutes of Health funded us with some $16 million to found programs across the United States of America. And there's a MOTEP of Cleveland, Ohio. There's a MOTEP of New York City. There's a MOTEP of Washington, D.C. There's a MOTEP of Tennessee. And there's about 10 states now that have MOTEP. And what they do is they go into the community, organize, educate, and empower the communities so that these communities will do what is necessary to get people to be educated and empowered so they'll be able to sign donor cards, have family discussions, leave organs and tissues in life and after death.
The numbers you gave me early on, they're at 35% or 30%.
Yes.
Are there still pockets in the United States where minorities, African Americans, Blacks, are not reaching those goals?
Yes, I think the area that we're least excellent is in the area of live donation. We have done a lot better with the deceased donors, mm-hmm. but with the living related and living unrelated donors, we haven't done as well, and that's the area that we are emphasizing now, as we try to reach the 35% mark to get more living donors. Because as a consequence of our disproportionate illnesses, many of our live donors aren't healthy enough to donate, so that we have to try to maximize whenever we have families that are healthy and can donate, that they can and should do it. Now, there are other things that now done, such as donor pairing, in which we can have a donor that's not good for, let's say, me, but is good for somebody else, go to somebody else, and that somebody else's donor can come to me. And that's called a donor pair or pair donation, which we use to try to get more minorities and majority patients transplanted.
In other words, if your son was willing to donate a kidney to you, but it wasn't a good match, that there might be another match for him out there, and they will, and take advantage of his willingness to do that.
That's correct.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Clive Callender, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about your good work.
Well, and I'd like those who are interested in helping us to go to www.motep.org or call us at 202-865-4888 so we can help spread the message and get more minorities to become aware of the need for donors, so that National Minority Donor Awareness Week becomes a great success.
We will post the phone number and that website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for anyone interested in getting more information. And once again, Dr. Clive Callender, he's Director Emeritus of Howard University's Transplant Program and founder of Minority Donor Awareness Week. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for letting me talk with you.
Wellness Wednesday will continue when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I should say welcome back. It's Wellness Wednesday. Some cancer survivors describe a journey to hell and back, but to help fight cancer, you could just pick one of the designated routes of Pelotonia, the three-day bicycle ride to benefit research at OSU's Comprehensive Cancer Center. Pelotonia kicks off its fifth year this Friday. Hard to believe. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. An important distinction of Pelotonia is that 100% of the funds raised by riders goes to the OSU scientists, undergrads, grads, and beyond at work on preventing, diagnosing, and treating cancer. Scientists who have to meet rigorous criteria to receive those grants. So far, $5 million in Pelotonia funds have been committed. 173 grants to 74 undergrads, 44 grad students, 3 medical students, and 10 international scholars, and 42 postdoctoral fellows from around the world. We have two such rider scientists here today, I understand, in the studio to talk about their work. Taylor Brooks graduated in May from OSU, and he's an undergraduate Pelotonia Research Fellow. Welcome to the show, Taylor.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Also with us is Dr. Samik Roy Chowdhury. He's a physician scientist in medical oncology at OSU. Welcome to the show, Dr. Roy Chowdhury.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Taylor, you study pancreatic cancer. Tell us why you thought you were a candidate for a Pelotonia grant. What inspired you to go for it?
So it all began with my mother. She suffered through breast cancer. So As she was going through treatment and things like that, I kind of stood by on the sidelines, and there was nothing I could do. I had to watch her endure it, watch her suffer. And from then on, that kind of motivated me to learn more about cancer. When I got into the lab I worked in and started volunteering, some of the postdoctoral researchers were interested in pancreatic cancer. Over time, I kind of cut my teeth and built a scientific skill set and worked with these researchers. And they thought it would be a good idea to apply for a grant, me do literature searches around pancreatic cancer and work with them to come up with a project. So that's what I ended up doing. And we got literature together and came up with something to submit to the fellowship committee.
Okay. So how much is the grant for? What'd you get?
So it was for 1 year. It was worth $12,000, and that allowed me to leave my previous job, which was, you know, to cover everyday type things, pay bills, eat food, to devote full time to cancer research and over at Wiseman Hall in the Comprehensive Cancer Center.
Now, are you a grad student at OSU?
Not currently. So I graduated with a degree in molecular genetics, and now I actually live in Cincinnati, and I'm taking a year off to work in their genomics center at Cincinnati Children's, and I'm applying for medical school right now.
What would you be doing if you didn't get the grant? You'd just be working and applying to medical school anyways, right?
Right. So I'd be working. So the previous job I had was not science-related, not cancer-related, completely different. It wasn't a bad job per se, but ultimately, my passion is science and cancer research. So I'd be spending most of my time doing that just to get by and volunteering in my lab. Ultimately, I mean, if I didn't get the grant, probably would not have come up with the project and would not have, done any of the things I was able to do in that year.
Dr. Roy Chowdhury, you just came to us from University of Michigan in April. I like to say that I'm a Spartan, so I always like to drag someone else through the muck with me. Welcome to Ohio State.
Thank you. Actually,
First of all, go Bucks. I'm actually a native of Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
I went to high school in Hilliard.
You're already indoctrinated.
So I need to first make sure it's clear that I'm actually not a Wolverine or a Michiganite in any way, but I respect where you came from, man. And OHIO. Thank you.
Okay. You study advanced stage and rare cancers and something called putative predictive genomic biomarkers. I know what biomarkers are. Tell us about the rest of that phrase.
Absolutely. So the concept is, can we take new technologies for understanding genomics, which is all the genes in the human body, and identify the genes that are altered in cancer, and these represent those biomarkers. And so the concept is, we've spent the past 10 years researching over 6,000 cancers and understanding the genes that are altered or mutated in those cancers. And at the same time, in parallel, we're developing smart drugs, so drugs that target specific genetic alterations. The concept would be then to marry those two, to bring that basic science technology into the clinic for patients that we see and try and match them to the right drug for the right gene target. And that concept is basically what you described with those predictive, putative biomarkers. They're putative in the sense that we have to test them and learn whether that's the right path that we need to choose, and that's the concept.
And the benefit is that you're just not shooting something out there that could be hurting other things. You're focusing, and then it's more efficient.
Correct. So if we can target the right pathway that's altered or the right gene that's altered, perhaps that might be more than one gene that has to be targeted in that patient. Can we then improve our response rates, improve the likelihood of success, the likelihood of cure, as well as avoiding therapies that may not have been effective for that patient?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday today. If you have a question or comment, we're talking with a couple of riders for Pelotonia this year and also grant recipients in one form or another. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a few minutes, so if you want to give us a call and tell us why you're riding, we'd love to hear from you. Once again, the number is 614-292-8513. Dr. Ruchaturi, from what I understand, funds raised by Pelotonia helped recruit you to Ohio State. That's what funded the recruitment. So you didn't exactly apply for a grant, right? What do you think about Pelotonia and the fact that undergrads like Taylor can benefit from it? It's very unusual.
Absolutely. So Pelotonia has multiple impacts on the way we do science and develop science at institutions like The Ohio State University. First of all, I think one of the plans that was laid out at the beginning of Pelotonia was to make sure that we funded young scientists and investigators, and that includes Taylor. That actually also includes me. I'm early in my career as a faculty member with great ideas, new ideas, innovative ideas that may not have otherwise been funded through other mechanisms. And I think the importance of funding the next generation of scientists, because it's people like Taylor who are going to go into a research lab and ask questions that perhaps I or other senior investigators like Dr. Caligiuri may not have thought of. And these new ways of thinking about old problems are one step towards making progress in science in general, and specifically for us, for cancer research.
Taylor, you've grown up with Pelotonia, really, right? So it's not unusual for you to think about the concept of giving undergrads funds to do scientific research. But you still had to be encouraged to do it by the people you worked for in the lab, you worked with in the lab at OSU. Do you think that Pelotonia does a good enough job getting out there and getting to undergrads and getting the message out there that they could be eligible for grants?
Yeah, I think so. So as it grows every year, a word gets out. And even when I applied, I thought the message was very clear. You know, go in the lab, work hard, prove yourself and be able to develop a project with a senior mentor. And then you have the ability to achieve this type of funding and to ultimately do what you want to do, which is research. I think what Dr. Ruchaturi said is a great point, and it's kind of a reciprocal relationship, I think. So while he may be a young investigator, and one of the ideas is for Pelotonia to target other young investigators like myself, I think seeing people like him being recruited and funded by an in-house agency is extremely inspiring, and inspires me to continue on this path and to really get the word out about Pelotonia just outside of Columbus, outside of Ohio, and to encourage other maybe in-house or other grassroots organization type fundraising events.
Now, you study myeloid-derived suppressor cells.
You got it.
Okay. I can say it, but I can't tell you what it is, so tell me.
So myeloid-derived suppressor cells are a type of cell that circulates in your blood. They're from the bone marrow, and it's theorized that in healthy people, they kind of dampen the immune response. So you catch a bug, you start getting a cold, and your immune system mounts an attack against it. It gets rid of the bug, but then it needs something to stop. So it's kind of theorized that these suppressor cells, along with other suppressive cell types, kind of turn down the immune response, or else you're going to have problems like autoimmunity and attacking your own cells. Now, in cancer patients, the numbers of these myeloid-derived suppressor cells are greatly increased, so much so that they are dampening the immune response all the time. And that's bad because your good immune cells most of the time do a great job at surveilling for tumor cells and kill them. So without that, with those cells being suppressed, the tumor can grow and perhaps metastasize.
Okay. Now, I was told that they're rare and hard to study.
Yeah. So it's very difficult in the lab setting. So we can isolate these cells from normal donors and from patients, but they're hard to grow in the lab. So that was the purpose of my project, was to figure out how we can set up a unique type of culture system targeting different pathways in these cells to let them grow, expand, and allow us to do lots of different experiments to learn about what makes them tick.
Now, you're both riders.
This year, I'm volunteering.
Okay.
Last year, I was a rider.
Okay. And
yes, absolutely. So this is actually my third time riding. As I mentioned, I'm an Ohio native. So
okay.
Even though I only moved here last September, 2012, this is the third year I've been riding.
Okay.
I'm actually currently signed up for 50 miles, but Eric, if you're out there, I am going to upgrade to 100. And I think I've done enough training, and I've certainly done enough fundraising. Actually, if you don't mind, I'd like to share with you some
Not
of
at
the,
all. I'd like to talk about fundraising.
Some of the creative ways, and I have a list here. I'm going to take a look at it, of how others, including my team, has been fundraising for Pelotonia. So there are bake sales, traditional bake sales, breakfast bake sales, badminton tournaments, wine tastings, Pelotonia-made wine, Pelotonia green socks, Pelotonia-oriented jewelry, Pelotonia homemade jam at the farmer's market in Worthington, Pelotonia ties made by Dr. Don Benson and his wife at Ohio State, a Pelotonia fashion show in Columbus, weekly ice cream socials at Ohio State, a Pelotonia karaoke event, which I missed, movie night at the Shoe with the Avengers, movie night at Ohio State's baseball diamond, Pelotonia special roasted coffee, a Zumbathon or a dance-a-thon, golf outings, custom bumper stickers, a trivia night, green light bulbs, for Pelotonia themed, a cornhole tournament, so it's our football roots, and my personal favorite, this is a plug, a t-shirt, it's a Beat Michigan and Beat Cancer t-shirt, 100% of those proceeds go to Pelotonia, and you gotta love it, OH.
Do you think it's as important for the research community at OSU, the scientific and medical research community, to be involved in the Pelotonia itself as it is in benefiting from it by way of grants and recruiting and that sort of thing?
Well, I think it's putting back into the system what you've been given, and inspiring others, including young investigators, other researchers, the community. I've had an opportunity to interact with riders who are patients, who are loved ones of people who've been affected by cancer, and I think that connection goes both ways. So when I meet people on the road riding or giving presentations or talks, people get to learn about what we're doing with the Pelotonia investment and how we're making a difference and why it's important to train people like Taylor and other young trainees. At the same time, it's important for Taylor to see what he's about to accomplish and who he's working for and who he's trying to help. And I think that's rewarding in both directions, and it's an absolute must that we all work together and ride. And you can ride as a rider on a bike. You can ride as a virtual rider, so you can fundraise and help others, and you're on the team. And you can also be a volunteer. And I believe that's what Taylor is going to be doing since he's coming in from Cincinnati with a couple right. members of his family. And part of that volunteer process is also why 100% of the funds from Pelotonia that's raised is actually committed completely towards cancer research. So it's in part subsidized by some donors in Columbus, Ohio, and also through the volunteer network that we have to help run the event, so that when I raise funds for Pelotonia, I can say 100% of both the T-shirt and of anything else that's donated goes to cancer research.
Taylor Brooks, when you're volunteering this weekend, do you wear a sticker or anything saying, ask me how I'm spending my Pelotonia grant?
Well, it's funny you say that. I have a T-shirt that says...
Yeah, I guess there is.
I have a big red T-shirt that says my research was funded by Pelotonia, and on the back and big letters that take up the entire back of the shirt, it says, thank you. And that's for the donors. And I really can't stress enough how important that is to recognize the donors and to say thank you, because that money makes this possible.
But I think it would be great to know, if I were there, I'd want to know who's gotten the grant. I'd want to talk to them about it.
Yeah.
What did you do? What are you doing with it? Are you going to wear a T-shirt like that, Dr. Chowdhury, or...
Absolutely. Probably at the ride, I'll probably wear the jersey because it's going to be hot. But afterwards, when I'm socializing with other riders, I'll definitely walk around and make sure we tell them what we're up to.
I said Dr. Chowdhury. I'm sorry. It's Dr. Roy Chowdhury. Well, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it. Good luck this weekend. Have fun volunteering. And I think I'm going to say it's going to be pretty good weather.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Sam.
Dr. Samik Roy Chowdhury, he's a physician scientist in medical oncology at OSU, and also Taylor Brooks, he's an undergraduate Pelotonia Research Fellow. Coming up, we're going to continue with Wellness Wednesday, so stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. For most parents, the last words on earth you want to hear are, your child has cancer. But the fact is that more than 11,000 kids under the age of 16 will be diagnosed this year in Ohio, in the United States. But most of the time, it takes years of genetic mutations to develop a tumor. So the origins of childhood tumors have been a bit of a puzzle. Recently, a research lab at Nationwide Children's Hospital found a missing piece. Dr. Peter Houghton, his director of the Center for Childhood Cancer and Blood Diseases at Nationwide, and he joins us now to talk about the findings. I should say welcome back, Dr. Houghton, because you were on a show a couple years ago that we did on Pelotonia.
That's correct.
So that's a little bit of a coincidence, but your work is, the research was revealed recently. In general, the risk of cancer increases with age, right?
That's correct.
Why?
So childhood cancer is very rare. As you say, there's about 11,000 patients annually in the United States, which is a pretty low frequency when you consider the number of kids. So it's generally thought that cancer is a product of both genetics of the patient plus environmental impact upon those genetics. So if you look at cancer as being a genetic disease, and that's one aspect, with increasing age, you have an increasing probability of accumulating mutations within genes that are critical for cell growth, survival, proliferation. And so your incidence of cancer goes up. Now, if you smoke cigarettes, you increase that quite dramatically in the case of lung cancer and probably for many other cancers.
So there are checkpoints in healthy cells that prompt them to fix damaged DNA before replicating. Tell us what your study found regarding the checkpoints in pediatric cancers.
Right. So within even single cell organisms, there are processes that protect the cell from genotoxic damage, so damage to their DNA. So if you think about it, it took about a billion years to make a single cell organism, such as a yeast cell. And those cells have devised processes that recognize DNA damage, repair DNA damage. They stop the cell cycle so that damage is not propagated into daughter cells. And these processes are essentially recapitulated in us. We have these very primordial processes with a few extra bits and pieces here and there that protect us from passing mutations on to cells during division. So the process is to recognize the damage, to halt the cell cycle so that the cell doesn't divide and then put that mutation into two daughter cells. And then there's a process of repair, which is very complex, involving hundreds of proteins. And if that cell damage cannot be repaired within a certain period of time, that cell will default into a death process. So the default is death, so you don't pass on genotoxic damage. What we found was a protein that is known as ATM, or ataxia telangiectasia mutated. It's a gene that was identified about 15 years ago as being causal for a disease which is characterized by neural degeneration. So children are diagnosed with this. They have ataxia, so they have problems in movement, and they ultimately die from this disease. So ATM is one of the proteins that's involved in the surveillance of DNA damage. It's conserved from single-cell eukaryotes to humans. And the observation that we made some years ago was that in many pediatric tumors models that we had developed, that this protein ATM was at very low levels. It was about a tenth to a twentieth of the level that you found in leukemia cells. So the obvious question is why? And the recent paper that we published really gives the mechanism, and it's a mechanism by which a signaling pathway within the cell suppresses the ATM messenger RNA so that the protein is not produced. What is particularly interesting in this case is that ATM is required after DNA damage to suppress this pathway. So we have identified both an upstream effector of the pathway, which suppresses it, and now when you can't suppress it, which occurs in most cancer cells, the pathway suppresses ATM. So it's sort of a negative feedback loop.
How does something like that affect or inform the kinds of treatments you might seek?
Well, I think there were a couple of surprises from the study. One is that that this pathway, which is essentially deregulated in most human cancers and also in pediatric cancers, is suppressing ATM. So the anticipation from that would be that you would see an increased frequency of mutations in these cells, but also that these cells would be hypersensitive to drugs that damage DNA. And there are two aspects where this fits quite nicely into childhood cancer. Firstly, kids get cancer at a young age, so the mutations are occurring very quickly. And ATM, loss of ATM rather, would certainly fit into an increased mutation frequency. The second aspect is that ATM is involved in the repair of DNA damage, and we use a lot of DNA damaging agents to treat children. And so these cells are hypersensitive to some of the agents that we use. And so it gives us an understanding of why many of these childhood cancers respond so well to ionizing radiation, to drugs that damage DNA.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Dr. Peter Howden, he is director of the Center for Childhood Cancer and Blood Diseases at Nationwide Children's Hospital. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. All right, so some tumors aren't cured by drugs and radiation. Well, that some tumors that aren't, you've said that some tumors that aren't cured by drugs and radiation can become resistant to treatments. That's what you were just talking about, or well, is this different?
Okay, no. So the two aspects. Pediatric cancers are highly curable cancers.
Okay.
So even solid tumors will be very, very sensitive to drugs that damage DNA, so or ionizing radiation or drugs. So these cells are exquisitely sensitive. The downside of losing ATM is the mutation frequency increases. So if you don't kill that cancer cell, it's possible that it would have a higher likelihood of mutating to resistance to drugs. And again, that fits pretty well with what we see clinically. You know, currently 70% of children with cancer are cured. And the 5-year event-free survival rate is approaching 80%. So there are clearly bad actors. But for the majority of children who have cancer, the outcome is relatively good. So the drugs and the ionizing radiation are very effective. The downside is that they have long-term effects which impair the quality of life of some of the survivors. But essentially, what we would anticipate from having low ATM is that you, one, would be hypersensitive to being killed by many of the drugs we use. But if you don't kill that cell, the likelihood of getting a resistance to that drug is increased.
Does any of this increase the likelihood of the cancer spreading to somewhere else, one kind of cancer spreading somewhere else in the body?
That I can't really answer because I don't think we've looked at this point at the role of ATM. But certainly the pathway we have studied, which is called the TOR pathway or targeted rapamycin pathway, is regulated by ATM. So if one, under stress conditions such as nutrient deprivation, which occurs in cancers, or hypoxia, which is low oxygen in cancer cells, ATM is activated and shuts down TOR signaling. What we do know is that TOR signaling is involved in metastatic spread. So if there is low ATM and it can't control TOR signaling or other mutations that also prevent this pathway from being suppressed, then that would lead to an increased probability of metastasis.
Tell us about the pediatric preclinical testing program that you run at Nationwide. What do you do there?
Okay, so the pediatric preclinical testing program, or PPTP, is an NCI-sponsored initiative to identify drugs that should be fast-tracked for treatment of kids with cancer. So one of the downsides of cancer being rare in children is that it's very difficult to identify new drugs that are truly effective that could replace the current drugs or could complement the current drugs. That is, with a 70% cure rate, there's very few children that are really eligible for experimental therapeutics. So we can't run very many clinical trials. In fact, if we look at the whole of the Children's Oncology Group, which covers all of the US and Canada and other countries in Europe, we can only run about 10 to 20 what we call phase one trials, which are basically to identify toxicities of drugs and define a useful therapeutic dose. And then to look at trials where we really look for drug activity, we can only run about 10 of those a year. So with 800 or so new drugs being developed, it would take us a long time to get through that number. So We use animal models to identify drugs that work in some pediatric tumors, or more broadly in different types of pediatric tumors. And we routinely run about 45 solid tumor models, which are all derived from children's cancers. So they represent sarcomas, neuroblastoma, various brain tumors, as well as acute lymphoblastic leukemias, where we run about 10 models. And the idea is to take drugs that are currently in testing in adults and see if any of those really work very well in the childhood models. That's basically, in a nutshell, what we do. And we've identified several drugs and drug combinations that have gone forward into clinical trials through the Children's Oncology Group.
Does Nationwide work with other institutions because of the shortage of eligible patients? Do you crowdsource your patients?
I think the pediatric oncology community is the most close-knit community in the world.
For that reason?
Yeah. I mean, we try and get every piece of data from every patient. And, you know, that's why I think in pediatric oncology, this is my own personal bias, is that that's why we've made so many advances so quickly in this field. In fact, when I was here last, we talked about a Pelotonia grant, that award ideas grant that I'd been awarded, and that's led to a further NIH funding.
Well, remind us about that, since it's Pelotonia Day.
Okay, so the story is, very briefly, is that I had just arrived at Nationwide Children's Hospital. I had been left off the email list for the Pelotonia Awards. And the day before they were due, I got an email saying, sorry, would you like to put in an application? And I thought about putting in something that I've been doing. And then I decided to put in something that was perhaps a bit out of left field. Came in the morning, wrote the grant, submitted by 10 o'clock. It got funded. And that subsequently led to a National Institutes of Health 5-year grant and a clinical trial through the Children's Oncology Group. And the work that we did on the Pelotonia grant is now going to lead to a pediatric brain tumor consortium clinical trial that hopefully will start in the middle of next year.
So you used your Pelotonia grant to leverage... It was used as leverage for an NIH grant.
That's correct.
Okay.
And now it will be part of a SPORE application, which is a clinical research grant, in which we will take what we found in the Pelotonia Award grant to the next clinical trial.
The incidence of diagnosis of childhood cancers, you said it's low, 11,000 a year nationwide, but it's been on the rise gradually. What do you make of that? Any ideas about why that might be?
It's really outside of my field of expertise, but one would imagine that environmental conditions will be involved. Obviously, familial cancers, if the families expand, the probability of having children get cancer is going to increase. I think we are going to see an onset of additional cancers in young people due to the obesity epidemic, because there's very clear linkage between obesity and different forms of cancer.
Like what kind of cancers?
Well, certainly breast cancer, ovarian cancer, cervical cancer are the three that come to mind, where there's a reasonable correlation.
And are those typical childhood cancers?
No, they're not. But my concern is that we will see those cancers develop in young adults or late adolescents.
There's always something, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, Dr. Peter Houghton, he's director of the Center for Childhood Cancer and Blood Diseases at Nationwide. Thank you so much for joining us today to share your research.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
To our listeners, you can be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me, Anne, on Twitter too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. If you want to check us out on Facebook, go to we'll have a link to that at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. From our website, you can also listen and watch the show live weekdays from 10 a.m. to noon. You can explore our archive. It includes audio, video, and podcasts of every show. That's at WOSU.org/allsides. And thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban, Leticia Wiggins, and Emmanuel Jochi, Annalise Dahl, and Andrew Zissler, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.